I'm Jamie Floyd, and you're listening to Midday on WNYC. After years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, a man returns to his family in Seattle. He's suffering terribly from PTSD, but an army friend has left him a cabin and a parcel of land in Alaska. And he decides to take a chance on the untamed wilderness with his wife and a teenage daughter. Kristen Hanna portrays this family's fight to survive in her new novel, The Great Alone. She's the best-selling author of more than 20 novels, most recently The Nightingale. The Great Alone is published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm so pleased that it brings Kristen Hanna to our New York studios. Kristen, hello.
Hi, it's great to be here.
This is a beautiful and affecting novel, and you start the book in 1974, and you infuse it with the music and the culture of the time, even a few images sprinkled throughout the book, some pictures. It makes it so relatable. Before we turn to the novel itself, I want to ask you about your own childhood, if you don't mind. So I understand that in real life, as the kids say, your own family piled into a VW bus back in the late 1960s and took off for the great unknown. How long was that trip? Where'd you wind up? What were your parents thinking? How did you feel about it?
You know, it's a riot when I think back on it now. But yeah, 1968, I was 6 years old. My parents had, you know, the VW van bus with the flower decals on the side.
Iconic.
Yep. And we were living at the time in Southern California. And my father decided that California was filling up too fast. Traffic was getting bad. And so he wanted to go in search of a new home. So it was me. I was allowed to bring a friend. My brother, my five-year-old brother, was allowed to bring a friend. And my three-year-old sister and our dog, and off we went. I believe we were gone for most of the summer. We went through 16 states.
Wow.
What I remember is a lot of hot, sweating days, you know, looking out a dirty window.
No AC in
that van. AC. with me reading a book, of course, and, you know, my dad telling me to look out the window and see, you know, what there was to see. And we basically all raised our hand in the Pacific Northwest and said, this is it. This is where we want to be. We saw the trees. We saw the blue water, the blue skies. And we said, this is where we want to be.
And those kinds of road trips seem so 60s or I guess early 70s. Do you think people still do those kinds of journeys these days?
I don't know. You know, I would assume so. I don't know. I don't do them anymore, I think, because I did so many as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the novel, The Great Alone, your fictional family, the Albrights, they leave Seattle. I don't want to give too much away. This happens really early in the story. But they leave in a VW van, and they head, or I guess do we call it a bus? I think we used to call it a bus.
I think it's a bus, yeah.
Right, right. And I want that thing to come back. They keep saying it's coming back. And they head for Alaska. How much did you draw on your own childhood experience in telling this story?
Well, actually, there's a lot of sort of personal information and sort of images from the landscape of my own youth in there. I'm very much Lenny. I'm the same age that she was. And so
Lenny is their 13-year-old daughter.
Right.
I was just going to ask all about her.
And as you mentioned, I bring a lot of my memories of music and food and books and what I was thinking back then. And, you know, that really infuses her character and the novel. And then it's also about sort of my dad's adventurous spirit in the sense that, you know, yes, we went off in our V-dub bus and went to the Northwest. Well, at some point, he decided to leave the Northwest again and go north again. And that was, I believe, in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. And he and my mom went exploring in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And they ended up meeting a lovely homesteader family and joining forces with them and building what would become our family business, which was an adventure lodge in Alaska.
Right.
And so I've been spending, you know, summers up there forever.
And you set, the book really gets going. You set most of the book in Alaska when this family finally gets to Alaska. And they're near Homer, Alaska, which I think is about 200 miles from Anchorage. Is that right? No roads in or out of Homer. Tell us more about that part of the country, especially at the time in which you set the novel.
Well, Homer is actually the populated part of where they go. That's like the last town. It's called Land's End for good reason. And the land that my Albright family has been given is across the bay at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula. It looks like it should be very populated, but in fact, there's no roads. There's glaciers, there's mountains, there's water. Everything cuts them off. So they end up being in this place that is truly spectacularly beautiful. I mean, in the summer, Homer and Soldovia, Alaska are just breathtaking. Mm. But as winter comes, of course, and the snow and the darkness and the difficult weather, they really become more and more isolated.
Yeah, and the two things that we folks who aren't as familiar with Alaska think about, of course we think of the beauty, but the two things we really think about are the cold and the darkness. Now, is that just mythology? Is that fair? I mean, is that right? Are those the two real challenges that folks would face, especially in a part that is not as developed like Homer?
Yeah, when you're talking about someplace remote in Alaska, you know, you are talking about long, really dark winters. You're in places like Fairbanks, for example. When you drive to the store or when you drive anywhere in the winter, your lights are on all the time. You have to leave your car running while you're shopping because it can be 60 below and it can be dark, you know, 16 hours a day. So it really takes a remarkable individual to live there. And that's where there's a town and where there's, you know, people to help you.
So what kind of skills would it take a family like this, especially without those skills, without that experience, to survive their first winter?
Well, you know, one of the things that I found so interesting about this was they were homesteading in Alaska into the 1970s, the classic homesteading where you could get a piece of land and prove it up over a number of years and then it would become yours. Mm-hmm. And so really, when you think about that, they are throwbacks to, you know, the American pioneers who were willing to go out into the middle of nowhere where there was not anything and build a life for themselves. And so that's really what was going on. You know, you're alone for a lot of the time because you're so isolated, you're so far from other people. So you have to be able to survive, to hunt, to fish, to garden, to tan, you know, to do everything.
And Ernst, the father in this family, is a bit of a forgotten American. He's a Vietnam vet. He had been a POW, so he's suffering from severe trauma. He does not seek out, even though his wife begs him to, seek out mental health support. So it makes some sense that he would look for this. In fact, he says to his wife, "This is exactly what I need. I need this kind of isolation and quiet and wilderness." And then you have these other wonderful characters, but kind of an odd community of folks. You've got this single black woman who runs the store. You've got this white supremacist guy, all living together and relying upon each other if some sort of crisis should arise, an illness, a weather emergency. How realistic is that in your experience?
Well,
they're far apart from each other, by the way.
Yes.
They're not piled on each other the way people in, say, New York City are.
No. You know, well, there's kind of, okay, so the first part of your question is about Ernst. And, you know, a man, 1974, a former POW, suffering from what was undiagnosed PTSD in a time when there was really no pervasive help for that, mm-hmm. no real dialogue about it. And
the vets were not welcome back.
I was just going to say, and I, you know, came of age during this time period. I wore, you know, we had in those days POW bracelets, you know, for men who were missing in action. And so it was very much a part of my youth to see that my friends' dads were not coming home, and then to see how the vets who were coming home were treated. And so that's sort of deeply ingrained in me. And so I wanted to deal with, you know, what could you do in that situation? And then, yes, like you said, he thinks, gosh, I'll just move off the grid and I'll get away from all of the stress and pressure of ordinary life and needing a job and trying to be like everyone else, and I'll be fine. And of course, he picks Alaska, where it's dark and remote, and he doesn't really have the skills or the preparation, you know, to take care of this. And so it actually worsens his symptoms.
Yeah.
But then with regard to the other people in Alaska, that is one of the things that I most wanted to bring to this novel, is sort of my love and admiration for the kind of people who do live in this environment. And, you know, you mentioned Large Marge, my woman who runs the store.
Love that character.
Who is like, you know, a former big city DC prosecutor who now lives in a yurt in the middle of nowhere and showers at the laundromat. And
showers everyone with love
and is,
when they come into town.
And is a big caretaker. And that is absolutely a woman that you would see on the streets of Alaska today. Every single person in this novel you could meet in Homer right now. And so, because it takes a special person, and I think what you get up there is this amazing sense of, you know, a fierce community of people who will protect themselves and protect each other. But they are all rugged individualists. No one tells anyone how to live. No one wants anyone interfering with, you know, how you choose to live. So it's all very idiosyncratic up there.
Yeah. And Marge is a truth teller. I mean, when they show up, she does not soft pedal what their life is going to be. I love that. I love that scene. Let's come back to Lenny, the 13-year-old character, which you have said you drew largely from your own experience. Tell us, and Lenora is her real name, but she's called Lenny. Tell us a little bit more about her experience. I mean, their love for one another, though it's a dysfunctional family, to say the least, but you can feel it's a fierce love that they have for one another. How does she cope with having a father like Ernst and his pain? You've said that you knew families like this. The ones who did have fathers come back. She's 13. I mean, that's a hard age anyway, even in the best of circumstances. Now she has a father who's in so much difficulty, and they're living in this remote place. How did you write that character? How did you get inside the head of this child?
Well, it really sort of, you know, began as, I mean, in a way, the great movement of the novel is her coming of age.
Yes.
So she begins as an adolescent who is really confronted with sort of normal adolescent issues and pressures, and then the extraordinary ones that come from her father. They move around a lot. She's always the new girl. She doesn't have any friends. She knows that her father is difficult. Her mother is very sort of fragile and makes excuses for the dad a lot. And so I think from that perspective, Lenny feels that she is the backbone of this family. And so she's constantly trying to put together and save this dysfunctional family, which I think is really common for children in this kind of an environment.
In so many environments.
In a lot of them. And so the interesting thing is, as her father's paranoia increases and he becomes more unstable and he begins to move into this sort of survivalist mentality, he is actually teaching her the skills she needs to survive apart from him. But of course, emotionally, he's her dad and Cora's her mother. And what she really wants most of all is for their family to just be happy.
I am right up against the clock, but I have to ask you just quickly about Cora. Because we're in the Me Too moment. Cora's the mom in this book. And as you say, she's rather fragile, but she is holding the family together. And she's a woman of a certain time. She's a vet's wife. Her dad comes back, and she's an unusual army wife because she protests while her husband's away. There were some women who did that. In just a moment or two, can you say, make a little tribute to Cora?
Well, I mean, and I, It's fascinating to me that this comes into part of the Me Too dialogue and women standing up. And I think it's really important to remind people, this is what it was like in the 70s. There was no help. And, you know, now we're getting to a place where we are being open. We are talking about this. We are looking to women's safety. And I think, you know, understanding women and women who stay and figuring out societally how to help them is a really of the moment issue.
I love the relationship between the mom and the daughter. It's beautiful. I'm Jamie Floyd. I've been speaking with best-selling author Kristen Hannah about her new novel, The Great Alone. Thank you for sharing it with us, and thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Coming up, it's historian Joshua Zeitz with his book, Building the Great Society, Inside Lyndon Johnson's White House. This is Midday on WNYC, and we'll be right back.